This week, I am joined by my good friend and Chief Strategy and Marketing Officer for Layered Insight, none other than Matt Alderman. As Michael Santarcangelo is on vacation, it'll be Matt and I taking the reins of the show for this week. In the articles of discussion, 5 techniques to nail the marketing aspect of your investor pitch, 18 things you should know before you quit your job and launch your own startup for comedic value. This article is just gold. Spotify says 2 million people figured out how to block ads. So we'll talk about how that might play into your startup or your own software project and how to prevent people from circumventing controls. In tracking security innovation segment, we've got BetterCloud. We've got ThreatX. RSA makes an acquisition. And more companies get funding and get acquired. So we'll talk about all those and more on this edition of Business Security Weekly.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show about security startups, how to secure your startup, and advice for security startups. It's Business Security Weekly. I need it from the top. Brought to you by...
Are you getting pressure to improve your data security? Would you like a faster, easier, better way to patch? Then you need to check out AutoMox. AutoMox is a cloud-native platform that patches and manages every endpoint, even remote servers and devices, including Windows, Mac, Linux, and third-party software, from a single dashboard. Improve your cyber hygiene, reduce your attack surface, and save 90% of the effort you spend patching. AutoMox, your patching system of record. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending your assets? Have you penetration tested your public assets? Start 2018 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night.
Welcome everyone to this edition of Business Security Weekly. As I stated, Michael Santarcangelo is on vacation this week, so Matt Alderman and myself will be hosting this week's show, and I'm super excited to welcome Matt to the show and talk about all of the fun topics we have prepared. Matt, welcome.
Thank you. Great AutoMox commercial. You know I still advise them.
So that's right. That's
right. I like that one. Yeah.
Yes. We like, you know, Matt's an advisor to the show and helps out with hosting here. So we consult with Matt on what companies are actually solving problems for people that we want to promote to our audience. And of course, Matt and I used to work at Tenable Network Security together. And now Matt's at Layered Insight. And talk about insights that Matt has given us into the DevOps and container space. Has just been awesome, Matt. Our pre-show conversation was just—it was so DevOps nerdy. I love it.
Well, you know, the AWS summit this week in San Francisco was pretty amazing for a one-day free event. You know, pulling over 8,000 people. It was a pretty interesting day. You know, AWS just continues to push through service offerings that are just going to accelerate DevOps and containerization and all the other fun things. So yeah, it was a pretty interesting Wednesday downtown at Moscone West.
That's awesome. I have a question for you about that event. I just want to make sure we do any announcements that we have. I know that we will be at Source Boston May 9th through the 10th. I will be speaking actually about Docker security or insecurity, as it were. And so that's going to be fun. I'm actively researching for that presentation, which is cool. And we'll be there selling our Hack Naked gear. And there's even a discount code, which I don't have in front of me because I have too many things going on. I have two laptops and a keyboard. The discount code is SW75WMKW. Get you $75 off Source Boston this year. It's going to be a fun conference. Make sure you join us for that. And Social Engineering Conference will be happening here in Rhode Island, June 6th. se-ri.org is how you go register for that. So speaking of conferences, Matt, you were at a one-day free event that was put on by Amazon for AWS. Is that correct?
Yeah, so AWS is doing one-day summits around the world. I know there's one coming up in New York, Atlanta, in a number of other cities. I think Sydney's Australia's next week. So they're one-day events kind of focused on just kind of educating the primarily the developers. I mean, there's a number of security companies and security folks that are showing up to these events, but it's kind of this lead up to reInvent. It's this, yeah. How do they stay connected into the community, right, as you lead up to reInvent, which is, you know, in late November. And so, yeah, just in San Francisco, it's one of the biggest, obviously. And in, like I said, there was somewhere north of 8,000 people for that one-day free event.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's interesting, Matt. It kind of ties into the, some of the work we do here at Security Weekly as we have our own internally developed software that has been morphing and changing. And that largely is the source of content for my talk at Source Boston. And, you know, we've migrated from not having containers and just having a monolithic application to putting it in Docker, to running it locally, to more recently putting it in AWS. And we haven't jumped into the Elastic Container Service, right, is ECS, where Amazon can right. actually host your containers. And that was largely due to just the learning curve. Like, it just, in the schedule, it didn't make sense. We had some local hardware fail, so we put it up in AWS, and then the next phase will be to move that into ECS, I think. And I think even a couple of years ago, people were kind of cautioning me that it's not quite ready. However, I think Amazon is actively working on that. And the reason, I think, for these one-day seminars is there has to be a lot of people in our same situation. They're like, I want to use ECS, and I go start reading the documentation, and the developers start reading the documentation, and we come back together and we're like, this requires a lot more planning and training than we have time for right now in the cycle. So let's move to the next phase and then continue researching and maybe attend one of these free events. So I think that all kind of came together for me.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing that most people need to realize is that AWS is actually making it easier every single day. At reInvent last year, they announced a new service called AWS Fargate, F-A-R-G-A-T-E. And that session was packed, every single session. They did a hands-on workshop. They did a couple sessions on it. Lines were down the hall. And what's interesting about Fargate is it's a true serverless container as a service offering. So ECS is really a managed container service, and EKS will be a managed Kubernetes service, but it still requires you to manage the orchestration clusters and some of the hardware aspects, which is, it's kind of a pain in the butt, right? And I think this is one of the areas where people are really struggling. Now that Kubernetes has pretty much won the orchestration game, people are having problems rolling their own Kubernetes clusters, right? Yeah. Whether it's on-prem or what Fargate does is it abstracts the entire orchestration layer. Literally, what you do is you identify what containers make up tasks and services, you allocate memory and CPU to them, and launch them. And you don't have to worry about the cluster management. You don't have to worry about the host management. It is going to revolutionize the way people deploy. And the customer list since November that's already on Fargate was amazing. I mean, some big names have already moved their container platform and their container apps into Fargate.
Yeah, I like this as a strategy because, you know, if you're a startup today and you're developing software, I mean, this is really new technology, but the benefits are just awesome. It's serverless, I think, is really catching on, and I don't need to maintain all of that infrastructure anymore. I can just worry about my application. A lot of things are taken care of. I think once it gets tied into the marketplace, folks can just go buy your app, automatically spin up an environment for them. It's even easier than what we have available today, right? In terms of doing it traditionally in AWS. So this is certainly the future. Sounds like the present for a lot of companies, but it's just awesome technology.
Yeah, and it's the pricing that's really going to drive this is you only pay for the containers when they're running. You don't have to pay for the dedicated EC2 instances and the entire cluster, even though stuff may not be running or it may not be fully running. You don't have to worry about the bin packing problem anymore to optimize how many containers can run on different hosts, et cetera. It's literally, if the hosts are running, you get charged. If the hosts aren't running, you don't get charged. It will revolutionize the way people deploy container applications. It's something to watch.
Yeah, we were actually going through that in our own architecture and designing a way to say, well, when we need to do CPU compute intensive stuff, we just spin up some more containers to do that and then take them down, like already that's in the design, I think, in most people's software today that are using containers, and it makes so much sense.
It does.
So we got a couple of articles to talk about today as well, including 5 techniques to nail the marketing aspect of your investor pitch. Very interesting. Matt and I have had lots of conversations about marketing as it relates to startup, as it relates to Security Weekly, as it relates to companies that we've worked for. And I thought some of the advice was sound, maybe not in the right order. You know, they kind of put like understand what your keywords are. And I think SEO is certainly a part of anyone's marketing strategy today. I think that also extends out into social media. But the next section talked about knowing your target audience. And for me, Matt, that's step one, right? Is you got to know who you're targeting. If you don't know who you're targeting, you can't do any marketing yet. Like, that's step one.
Yeah, and this is where we've talked before about what I call the conversation roadmap. Understanding who buyer is. What are their pain points and challenges? How do you solve those in a way that provides value, right? So knowing your target audience is super, super important, not only for your marketing plan, but also for the pitch, because you have to be able to articulate to the investors who you're selling to. Mm-hmm. Are you selling to development? Are you selling to operations? Are you selling to security? Those all have unique challenges. And if you're trying to sell to everybody without kind of focusing a little bit, yeah, it gets really, really hard to be successful.
It's one of the screening questions we actually ask of all our potential sponsors here in Security Weekly. In order for us to do quality work for you, we have to understand who you're trying to target and with what message. If you don't know that, not probably ready to work with us yet, right? Because we have got a network of shows and we understand messaging and positioning. So, you know, you got to tell me what companies you're targeting, the personas that you're targeting, what problem you're solving, and how you're messaging and positioning around, you know, that foundation. Once you have all that together, then we can say, okay, we think these activities will be the most beneficial to you to reach your target audience with a message that, and in our case, the end result is to get someone to take an action. And I think all of your marketing activities, well, maybe not all, but most of them, I think should compel people to take some action. And for me, that's kind of the final step. Like, once you've defined all of that, what action do you want people to take? Do you want them to register for a demo? Do you want them to just go purchase your product? I mean, it depends largely on what you're selling. But that action, I mean, we call it call to action. I hate that term. But you want them to do something. When they see an ad on Facebook or when they listen to a webcast or whatever your marketing activity is, has to lead them on a journey that ultimately ends up in them taking some action.
Yeah, right. The purpose of marketing is to identify potential prospects, nurture them, and turn them into leads so you can try to sell to them. I mean, that's just marketing 101. So all these activities that you're doing, whether it's a campaign or an advertisement or whatever, you're trying to convince them to take an action in some form or fashion. And they can vary, but that's what you're trying to do. Mm. But you better put them in the right place so you keep them. Because if what you're saying in your article or in your ad doesn't link to something logical on your website, then they get confused. And so, you know, as you have seen, I'm a big believer in kind of mapping those out so that I know which campaigns take prospects to the right places on a web page so that they get maximum value and then continue that journey.
And, you know, speaking of value, one of the things the article says is to communicate your budget and your marketing spend to your investors. And I think there's kind of like a narrow scope, right? And I think that if you're pitching to an investor and you're like, oh, we're not going to spend any money on marketing. And then the other end of the spectrum is, well, we're going to spend all this money on marketing. Be prepared to defend that position. And some of it ties back to what Matt just said, being able to recognize a return on investment from your different marketing activities and know what's working well for you and doing more of it, or doing something slightly different if you've already exhausted that avenue, if you feel like. But communicating the value of your marketing spend to your investors, I think, is probably one of the most important things in terms of budgeting.
It is. It typically shows up as a pretty big line item when you think about your budget plan and how you're going to spend the investment dollars, sales and marketing is a big chunk,
sure.
and R&D is a big chunk, right? Yep. And so you have to be able to defend those spends. If it's all R&D, then the investor is going to be like, well, how are you going to generate leads, right? If it's all sales and marketing, then, you know, what do you need to do to propel the product through the next stages? So there is a balance between those two numbers. But look, the investors are going to dig into them, and you're going to have to be able to justify what's in there.
The next article is about branding. And I added this article basically because when we've talked about the Play Bigger book and creating your category, they really poo-poo a lot of traditional branding efforts, Matt. So I was wondering your thoughts and opinions on maybe some of the books here and the overall general view of branding, you know, today in the marketplace, especially as it relates to security.
Yeah, this gets a little interesting, right? I haven't read some of these books. I kind of read through some of the abstracts of the titles, right? Branding's interesting in general, right? You've got to come up with that kind of category point of view that you want, but then you have to build this brand around that. And, you know, there are some traditional components. I'm still kind of traditional in some respects. You know, digital marketing has its place and drives generation and leads and some other things, but people are going to look for a little more substance sometimes. And so, you know, I really think about brand and theme and how you want to portray yourself as a company out there. And so, yeah, you can't just create a category and walk away and go, yep, I'm done. Mm. Right. That's it. We're good. We created the category. So now let the dollars flow in. No, you still have to create a brand. You have to educate the market. You have to bring people to your point of view. You have to educate them on that and then sell them on the value. And that's some of the things, you know, a couple of the books don't go into depth. These right. books go in there a little bit, and it's really kind of merging the two together,
yeah.
which is the interesting art/science.
But I think that traditionally what I found when people think of branding, they think of it in that phrase, which I'm not a huge fan of, that is, I want to get my name out there. And I'm like, yeah, that's not good enough. But what Matt said was, get people on board with your point of view. Ah, now you're on to something, right? They have to know who you are, sure. But a very close follow-on to that I think needs to come together is, get them on board with my point of view. What do I believe the problem is, and what do I believe the best way to solve that problem is? And that's when we work with our sponsors. That's what I like to convey in kind of the branding portion of our services, is not just getting your name out there, but what problem do you solve, and then what's your point of view on that problem? And make sure that that's in your branding in some way, shape, form, or fashion. I mean, sure, that can tie to your name, that can tie to your logo, can tie to your tagline, but giving a little bit of information, traditionally we'd call that messaging and positioning, right? Giving them a little bit of that with your branding, I think, is really important.
Yeah, exactly, right? It, just because you created a category that, you know, nobody may know about, you have to position it in, it's still back to what the buyer is trying to solve. He's got a problem. He's looking for a solution. So you have to be able to articulate that and put your spin on it. This is, you know, we've seen companies do this well. We've seen companies not do this well. But, you know, it's got to be more than just, ta-da, I'm here. That's it.
Right. Yeah,
I'm done,
exactly.
Right?
No. Exactly. I think that the next article really kind of speaks to that a little bit too, because if you're creating your own startup or maybe you've gone to work for a startup, this article, it says 18 things you need to know before you quit your job and launch your own startup. Is really some of the struggles they talk about in this article is about communicating what you're doing, communicating your brand, communicating your point of view and your problem, and making people understand that. And oftentimes when you just go launch a startup, you're still developing that. You're still developing your product. You're still trying to define your problem and define the ways in which you communicate that problem and solution out into the marketplace. So when you tell your parents, as the number one example, your parents think this is a phase that you're going to get over, right? Like, hey, I just quit my job and I'm going to work for this startup now. And, you know, the next logical question is like, well what do you do? And you may still be figuring some of that stuff out, and that's okay. You know, number two is your friends don't get it either, right? Your friends are like, hey, you went to work for the startup. Well, what do you guys do? It's go, well, you know, you come up with this big, long explanation, and they're like, I still don't get it. And I think that's a maturity point for your messaging, right? If you can tell your friends and family what you do and they get it, you might be onto something with your marketing and messaging.
Well, I've been in security for over 20 years and my wife still has no idea what I
do.
So
right? Yeah.
I must be bad at least explaining it to her because she still doesn't get it.
Right. There's some other fun things in here too. Your job will be hard to explain. You know, you'll be overworked and underpaid. And I think that's certainly a perception of startups, right? Sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, before. I think there's, there's some interesting ones in here and you just hit on one, right? People think startups are fun. I mean, they are if you're in the right mindset. If you're a guy that's done 9 to 5 in corporate America and think coming to a startup means I get to work 9 to 5 and have all this fun with new technology, think again, okay? You don't work a 9 to 5 job.
Nope.
You're working 10, 12 plus hours a day, 6, maybe sometimes 7 days a week, right? I mean, startups are a lot of work. And if you come in with, you know, the attitude that, you know, you're going to get the same salary. No, startups have limited budgets. Mm-hmm. Salaries are not the same when you come to a startup. So there's a lot of people that, you know, want to get into startups but haven't been here before. And you have to realize it's longer days, it's longer hours, it's more days, and it's less pay. These are just some of the realities. You know, my parents haven't cared what I've been doing for years personally. So, you know, I don't have to worry about explaining it to my parents, but sometimes your wife and your kids are like, well, what is that that you do? Why do you have to go to California, you know, every week or every other week? But
I think you have to, one of the things I think it comes down to is you have to be really comfortable with risk, right? And realize that you're working towards a goal. And if it goes well, things are going to go well for you, right? You're going to get acquired. You're going to get funded. You're going to start turning a profit. There's a lot of work that leads up to that, but it's very risky. And you're putting in a lot of time and effort and energy to something that really hasn't quite taken off yet. And there's a lot of risk involved with that. So, and you have to be comfortable with that. You can't be the type of person that's like, oh, that's too risky. I don't know if I want to put that much time into, you know, this part or the other. You have to make informed decisions and run with them. And just be comfortable with risk.
Yeah, exactly. Because 90%+ of these companies are going to fail.
Yeah,
they are. They may not get initially funded. They may get funded, but then the exit's not good. We'll talk about one of those later in the news articles. There is a ton of risk here. And if you are not willing to take on some of that risk, startups are not the easiest thing for people. I love it because, look, I love the space. I love new technology. Love trying to solve these problems. But look, there's a lot of risk in what you do every single day. So be ready for it.
Yeah, I also think this extends out into if you have your own company today or you're working for a company and you want to start a new initiative. Many of these new initiatives are almost like startups and you have the same considerations. And it might be risky to embark on this new venture, this new service, this new product from an already established company. Now, there's a little less risk because you've already established a business and hopefully you're making money. And now you're going to take some of that and invest it into something new to expand and or pivot. There's risk in that too. And maybe you want to try that first before you go start your own startup is maybe inside of your role today, come up with some kind of new initiative and try and see that through. And a lot of those initiatives fail. I mean, we could talk for a long time, even just in security, about companies that have created a new product or service, and it just hasn't taken off, right? And to me, that's kind of a form of a startup within an existing organization.
Yeah, exactly. And there's good places. You know, the Googles and the Amazons of the world, man, they love to spin up new projects internally. If you're working for one of those companies, it gives you that great entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah.
And really prepares you for, you know, maybe going out on your own and doing it. That's why you see a ton of people from Google and Amazon, you know, starting companies because they get to experience aspects of that internally.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're working for a Fortune 500, that may or may not exist. And trust me, it's a very different environment on the other side.
Yeah, absolutely. GFI Software has launched a different type of subscription model. And I've seen this story come up a number of times. And they're certainly targeting the mid-market. What was your take on this, Matt, as you and I have had lots of conversations about how to spin up new services and package them for the, especially for the security market?
Yeah, this one's not really new to me because I look at it and go, okay, they're providing an unlimited bundle on a per user basis. I don't think that's really new. See, new to me would be like a consumption model. You pay for what you use and you get billed for it. That's kind of the leading edge from a pricing perspective. I didn't really see anything new in here. They're just bundling all their packages together in an unlimited per user based pricing. That's not new.
There is a pricing model that I thought was new. And I want to get your take on it from a startup that I've been speaking with that I'm really impressed with. And when I asked them about their pricing and packaging, and of course, everyone gets a little funny when you ask them about price. And I'm like, all right, if you don't want to tell me the price, that's fine. I get it. But tell me how you package it. How do I buy it? Do I buy it on a per user basis? Is it a price per packet? A price for storage? Like, what is it? And the most innovative one I've seen lately, Matt, is they said, well, our cost to our customers is 1% of their security budget. And I'm like, well, hold on, back up a second. You have to trust that they're telling you what their actual security budget is. And then their pricing model is basically, we're 1% of your security budget. I was like, wow, that's interesting. Certainly new. I don't know if you've seen those kind of models before, Matt, but I thought that was interesting.
I haven't seen that model. And I don't know if that's good or bad yet.
Right.
Because look, security doesn't necessarily get the budget that the rest of the IT team does, right?
Sure.
It's probably, you know, on average, 4% of the IT budget. I think you just limited your market scope a little bit by trying to charge 1% of a 4% budget. And again, what's the value for that 1%? That's the interesting question for me, is because you have to articulate value in your pricing too. And if you're not managing the overall security portfolio or reducing costs across all of it, man, that's a hard pricing model to justify.
This article, Don't Let Taxes Kill Your New Business, I thought was kind of interesting, you know, given it's tax season. My best advice, Matt, and I don't know what your advice is with taxes and as it comes to startups or you know, starting a new business, my advice is always just get a good accountant, and don't get just any accountant. Shop around to accountants that have experience helping new businesses or startups, or maybe accounting firms that cater to startups in security or in technology. They're best positioned to help you. No one, if you're running a startup or in, you know, technology in any kind of role, like, tax expert is a far cry from looking at network packets or any kind of other expertise. And my advice is always to get a qualified accountant, because tax laws are constantly changing and there are decisions in there that can really either help or greatly hurt your business if it's not established correctly from the beginning.
Agreed. So I you know, having done a few of these, there are a couple probably tips here that I definitely take a look at, right? Income tax, to me, if you're going to do this, you build and ask for, you bring the money over on a K-1 to your personal taxes, you pay at your personal tax rate versus a C-Corp, right? Mm-hmm. That's how I do it. I've got two of them. I don't have employees,
right?
For a specific reason, because employment taxes get expensive. You know this, right? Having the Security Weekly stuff. I like 1099s because I don't have to pay employee taxes, or they're partners in the business, right? Mm-hmm. So I've avoided employees in my small businesses just for that reason. If you file as an S-Corp, you avoid self-employment taxes versus being self-employed. Mm-hmm. So you don't get the double whammy. So that's why I always recommend, you know, if you're going to do an LLC, file it as an S-Corp with the IRS in the timelines you have to, so you're recognized that way. You'll have to file your 1120S and then you take your K-1 and put it on your personal, but it will reduce some of the double taxation. So those are just simple tips that I've had to deal with over the years. So,
well, in the C-Corp too, and again, you know, I'm not a tax expert, right? But I've read some of the advice from folks, and in the startup world, they actually recommend, some people recommend that you start off with a C-Corp. Now, that may help you in funding, sure, and I think if you're goal is to do this startup and, you know, put in 7 days a week and that's what you're doing, and your goal is to get funding early on, that is what some are recommending. Again, I don't want to be your tax consultant, right? I'm just saying what some people have recommended. And some of the downsides are that double taxation that's associated with the C-Corp, because you will pay a little more in taxes. However, what some experts have said, when you go to investors is they're looking for that C Corp to already be created as kind of like a little checkbox before they invest. So it's always best to do your homework, talk to your advisors. Maybe if you're going to get funding like right out of the gate, maybe talk to your investors and say, what do you look for in a company and how it's set up, especially tax-wise and corporation filings? What do you look for? And base your decisions on that. And it's going to be different for everyone.
Yeah, it is. But if you're going to go get funding, I can almost guarantee you, you're one going to open it as a Delaware C Corp.
Yep.
I mean, that is almost table stakes.
Yeah.
If you're going out and get investment and you're going to build out the company.
Yep. So I added this next one in here about Spotify. They've kind of been in the news lately about, you know, basically their revenue model as it relates to ads and premium services. So in the first story that came before this one, they figured out that people were able to cheat the system and get, premium services without paying. Now they've also come out and said that people have figured out how to block ads as well within their software. And they've got this problem that Matt, you and I have dealt with, and many of us in the security that you've worked for a company or started a company have dealt with. You know, how do you prevent abuse of your product and circumventing controls that you put in? And let's face it, security has that problem in a big way because our audience, a large percentage of them are essentially hackers. And if there's a way around it, they're going to find it. And Spotify, I think, is suffering from this in a big way. Now, Spotify is a big company today, and so they have this problem at scale. How do you recommend, Matt, that you deal with some of these issues, especially early on, and not having, you know, potential customers rip you off, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, there's two potential mistakes that happen here, right? One is you give away everything for free, and then you realize, oh, shoot, I have to figure out how to get customers to grow their revenue. So, you know, one recommendation is don't start with a unlimited full offering because it's really hard to peel that back. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to create additional revenue when you've given everything away up front. On the flip side of that, then it's on these free offerings, right? What do you give away for free? And then how do you drive upsell into a paid product, right? So Spotify gives away, you know, aspects of their service for free, but you get a bunch of ads and the ads compensate Spotify for this.
And also, Matt, Spotify in their free offering, because I'm an audiophile, I researched this, their free offering is a much lower quality. And if you pay the money in subscription, which I do, you get a much higher quality because I have a headphone fetish and I've been an audiophile like my whole life, essentially. So that's one of the ways they're differentiating.
Right. And so from a security perspective, you have to think the same thing. You're going to give away a free product. Well, how much of that functionality do you give away for free? And then where do you draw those lines to get somebody enticed to actually buy, actually pay for a product, right? And so you've seen freemium offerings from others. You know, when I was at Qualys, we did this with Scan, right? It was limited to a certain number of devices. Mm-hmm. It kind of got you hooked. That allowed you to move into a paid product that gave you more capabilities. Tenable did this with Nessus Home. Again, pretty limited. Gave you the opportunity to move into Nessus and the enterprise product. So there's ways to construct your offerings that allow you to do free, but you got to think about all the licensing packaging aspects of that early on so that you can enforce functionality early in the product to give you that packaging capability. It's always hard to retrofit licensing later into some of these products, especially as they started as like, I'll give you everything for one price, and then you figure out how to break it up and enhance it and charge differently for it. So
well, there's the open things. There's the open source model too, which are varying degrees. Mm-hmm. In active countermeasures, for example, we've got a version of our product, and it's a portion of the paid one that's free and open source. And you let people go and install that, and then you know when they want more, they move into a paid product. And we've seen that a lot in security. Today, one of my projects that I've been working on and will continue to work on is OSSEC, which is an Alien Vault open source project. And, you know, that's kind of interesting to see how these companies have maintained. You know, of course, Tenable long ago made that decision that open source, that just wasn't the model that they wanted to go down and, abandon that open source model. Other companies have kept that open source model and kept the version of the product open source. The question becomes, like what do you open source and how much functionality is there versus your commercial product, I think is that's the real balancing act.
Yeah, and in a perfect example from we started earlier is Docker, right? Docker Community Edition, widely adopted.
Yep.
Docker Enterprise Edition, what's the difference, right? Well, there's enterprise features. But look, Red Hat's done a really good job of taking the open source CE version of Docker and building a commercial product around
yes.
it. And because everybody uses the open source, it gets adopted pretty fast, right? So there are models, and Red Hat's a really good example of this, of how you can leverage open source and build commercial products around it. They're probably one of the best examples out there. So if you're looking at that model, go figure out what's made Red Hat successful, because that's the model you should probably try to copy.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that drives people to get a commercial product versus open source is, well, for one, you get to play with the features, but that's oftentimes a lot of work. Like when I'm playing with OSSEC, like I have to go read the documentation, install each agent by hand, and sure, there's other open source scripts that allow me to deploy agents, but it's a lot of reading, it's a lot of manual configuration. When you switch to the commercial products, oftentimes a lot of that stuff is automated. A lot of that stuff they'll send people out when you purchase the product to help you configure it and get it set up, and that's just included in the cost. So a lot of it is that maintenance and deployment that is kind of the first step of nice services that you get by actually paying for the product. And of course, a lot of people do the open source model, and I like to think of that as kind of a proving ground, right? If I can go prove that it works, and I'm like, hey, look at the benefits we get. And by the way, if we wanted to roll this out to the whole organization, we can go get a commercial product, commercially supported. And it's not just for support. When I look at the difference between open source and commercial products, I'm not looking for necessarily someone to pick up the phone and call. I think that's kind of a lame excuse. What I'm looking for is the commercial product has a product manager or a team of product managers that are balancing and implementing features and having influence over what features are being built in to solve my problems. And I think that's the real benefit to a commercial product. I think people think of it as I can pick up the phone and call someone. We've all had our support experiences, right? I think the real benefit is the management of those features and the development process and product management. Do you agree, Matt?
Yeah, in documentation and all the other things that go along with running commercial products, right? Mm-hmm. You have a team that is definitely trying to figure out how to enhance it for their customers and for new customers, prospects. And so they're going to listen, right? And they're going to figure out how to add some of these features for you. When you're in just pure open source, you're kind of at the mercy of the community of whatever they feel like adding to the open source version. So yes, commercial versions definitely have more focus on feature functionality roadmap than the open source will.
And what I found, and I talked about it in my presentation at InfoSec World, when you talked about documentation, Matt, is when you're in open source world, reading the documentation, I've experienced, and everyone was nodding their heads in agreement when I explained this too, is that you get some pretty good documentation on how to like download, install the software and some maybe initial configuration. And then as you go through the documentation, you'll find how to do this like really super cool thing to find this really new and interesting event in your network or super technical thing. But like everything else in the middle is missing. Like, how do I deploy it out and maintain it and get all these features and tie all the pieces together? Like everything in between is missing in open source. You got to figure that out on your own, which I mean, that's the nature of open source. When you go to commercial products, I think when we say better documentation is you get that full suite of guidance, right? From installation to deployment, to tying all the pieces together, and also some of the advanced stuff as well.
Yeah. And the integration, right? Instead of just this kind of swagger page by itself, you actually get some information about what those APIs are actually doing.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, that's definitely more important.
Awesome. All right. So with that, we're going to take a short break, come back and talk about tracking security innovation, acquisitions and funding rounds for security companies coming up next. Innovation's a funny thing in a cosmic sort of way. While it drives your business forward, it also exposes new risks that can slow you down. As an IT or security professional, Every day, you need to know, are you vulnerable? Are you compromised? And finally, are you optimized to quickly spot and resolve issues to keep your operation humming? It's your responsibility to help the organization safely and reliably implement the latest connected technologies. So how can you outsmart this little paradox? Rapid7 solutions are powered by advanced analytics and an unmatched understanding of the attacker's mindset. Visit Rapid7.com to learn more about how Rapid7 products transform data into action. Today's determined attackers easily bypass even the most advanced network defenses. Trying to ramp up staff to detect their backdoors can cost thousands of dollars and take months, even years. With Active Countermeasures AI Hunter, we enable junior analysts to detect even the most advanced backdoors in a matter of hours. Sign up for a demo and purchase our product today by visiting activecountermeasures.com/BSW. Active Countermeasures. Make every analyst a hunter. Domain Tools help security analysts turn threat data into threat intelligence. They take indicators from your network, including domains and IP addresses, and connect them with nearly every active domain on the internet. Those connections drive risk assessments, help profile attackers, guide online fraud investigations, and map cyber activity to attacker infrastructure. Fortune 1000 companies, global government agencies, and leading security solutions vendors use the Domain Tools platform as a critical ingredient in their threat investigations and proactive defenses. For more information, visit securityweekly.com/domain tools. Welcome back, everyone, to Business Security Weekly. Just a note, check out our fine friends at itpro.tv, itpro.tv/securityweekly for all of your training needs. Great supplement to all your other training activities. You can buy a subscription for your business and get all your employees access to 3,300 hours or more of security training. So make sure you do that. I want to talk about some of the happenings in security companies and security startups and acquisitions today. I think Matt and I probably will start with the RSA acquisition of FortScale, which on the surface now, Matt, and I know you've analyzed this, you know, you used to work for RSA, I believe, right? And it seems to me that UEBA, the end user or user entity behavior analytics, was a thing where people created whole companies around this concept of analyzing your user behavior for security events. I think largely that's gone from a category to a feature. And the recent string of acquisitions and exits from these companies are either they're exiting via acquisition or they're pivoting to do something else in addition to stay alive and not get acquired and continue to grow. And certainly with RSA, NetWitness now basically just bought this functionality of end-user behavior analytics, and we've seen a lot of these SIM companies making acquisitions like this. Is that your assessment on the surface as well, Matt?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've known the user behavior analytics was a feature, not necessarily a full category. Makes sense to integrate that into the SIM technologies, which is the basis here, the NetWitness platform being that platform for RSA. And so what you're seeing is you're starting to see the consolidation of what people thought was a market, but really was just a feature. And there's other examples out there, but this one is really starting to play itself through. And there's an article out on Calculist that mm-hmm. kind of breaks this one down. So I want to read a couple sentences here because I think it's really interesting to see kind of how this deal went down. So it says the Israeli-based startup was acquired for less than investors had put into the company. A person familiar with the matter told Calculist. Okay, so $23 million in, mm-hmm. RSA paid less than that. So this is a good deal for them.
Right, yep.
Some of the FortScale 30 employees will be transferred to RSA's research and development center in Israel. That's been built over the years. Mm-hmm. RSA's done a number of acquisitions in Israel actually has a really good focus there. And then it says FortScale's founder and chief executive, Aydin Tendler, will not remain with the company. So think of this as an acqui-hire, I think, at the end of the day. So that's how this one played out.
They bought their technology and a certain percentage of their R&D and developers, and then the rest of the people, assuming, got some kind of exit money, right? They basically bought them out and said, you can go off and do your next startup now.
Yeah, it doesn't get into details in the article, but Yes, that's basically it. And this functionality, which makes sense, will get integrated into the NetWitness suite, I'm sure, and will enhance some of the analytics within the NetSuite product, the NetWitness product. So yeah, it makes perfect sense, but not a good exit for FortScale at the end of the day.
No,
but a great acquisition for RSA. RSA because they got it on the cheap.
Well, and you know, I think this goes back to our conversation about risk. Certainly, they were banking on the fact that UEBA would become a category of its own. They were banking on that they could do it better than anyone else and become that category king. As everything unfolded, turns out that's not the case. At least they were able to exit, right? I mean, there is risk, sure, but you know, you were able to exit. Not clear how, you know, financially they were impacted by that, but hopefully they came out of it, you know, not in the red, certainly, and, you know, can, like I said, go off and do their next startup. So, but that's, you know, one of those risky things that we were talking about in the last segment.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, when you pay less than what the investor's in, typically that money goes back to pay investors, not necessarily founders.
Yeah.
But hopefully they took care of, you know, some of the founding team, but you never know. Mm-hmm. That's part of the risk here is preference.
Right. So what do we want to talk about next? I thought this one was interesting. FIDE raises $3 million in seed funding. It's essentially a security app for iOS. Now, I know that oftentimes funding for apps is pretty tight because there's just so many apps for Android and iOS and so many companies that are like, we're going to be the next most popular, you know, app in the App Store. And that's just not the case because it's a very crowded market. In this case, they give $3 million in seed funding to not just an app, but a security app, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, my concern here, though, is my CTO, Asif Awan, actually exited, that did something similar, right? It was an app wrapping technology for iOS and Android to protect applications. Mm-hmm. Aruba bought it. So it's part of the HP Aruba side of the house.
HPE, so, HPE Aruba.
Right.
Sorry. I caught up with them in Boston a few weeks ago.
And so what's interesting here is now you've got another startup. There's already been a couple exits in this space. So is there still really a big demand for this? Because there are other technologies out there that do this. You know, it's a good seed round, $3 million in seed funding. But the question will be, can they get an A? I just don't. I don't know that this. I don't know. I'm not sure that this has legs. I've seen other stuff already here. Other people have solved the application security issues in iOS. This is not unique in any way. So we'll see.
Yeah, this seems to be a separate app that can protect the consumer against phishing and account takeover attacks. In the startups that you talked about, I know of another one. That does the, like, we basically provide developers with a wrapper that provides a security abstraction layer. And that sounds like what the company you were describing, and sounds like there's other startups in that realm. This one's targeted at consumers, which that's going to be somewhat of a tough sell to convince consumers that they need, you know, security. And not only need security, like, you got to download this other app to get, you know, some security protections.
Yeah, exactly. Consumer space is tough, I think, in some respects. So I try to stay away from there. But like I said, we'll see, but I'm not convinced yet.
BetterCloud closes a $60 million funding round to bring their total to $107 million. They're touted as a SaaS operations management platform.
You know, I'd never heard of these guys before. And so when I was out doing the research, I'm like, who do they compete with? I'm like, I don't know this space that well. And the best way I could think about describing it is a CASB for SaaS applications or something, right? I mean, they're trying to provide a level of security and compliance around people accessing SaaS apps. This is a Series E round, right? So they've raised a number of rounds. The total's, you know, over $100 million now to help them scale. I couldn't really understand some of the value here, unfortunately, when I kind of went to their website. So I don't know how this plays out in the long run. You know, good for them. They took an E.
Yeah, right. They must be doing something. Well, if they're in an E, they have customers that are
right, exactly.
Benefiting from the solution. So, it looks like this might be an Israeli-based startup. At least one of the investment firms is an Israeli ventures. This is ContGuard. It says they're the leading provider of supply chain shipment monitoring and business intelligence services. I think that's pretty fascinating. I think anytime we've looked at least that I've looked at securing your supply chain, it's kind of like a Hollywood script, right? Especially when you do threat modeling for your supply chain. Like, it's who's going to poison the supply chain? Who's going to hijack the supply chain? We covered one of a somewhat funny article and interesting where they were going after the marijuana supply chain in Washington State and actually hacked the state of Washington, the system that controls where people have to register the source and destination and times when shipments are moving. That'll also be registered with the state, and they attack the database seemingly to hijack shipments of marijuana that is legal in Washington State. So anytime we talk about this, you know, protecting the supply chain, the threat modeling is like totally out of a Hollywood script, right?
Yeah, and in, you know, this is the other version of container security when you think about moving, you know, large cargoes all over the place on big ships, which are all containerized, right? And so the name's interesting because it's ContGuard, which kind of reminds me of, oh, they're trying to guard the container shipments.
Yeah.
So I just chalk this up to the other container security.
Right. Yeah, it is the other container. And I'm sure that those containers are tagged with, you know, some type of wireless RFID or some similar technology to track where the container goes. And, if you're a large company and you're moving shipments like that, I think you absolutely need some type of solution that's protecting your supply chain. It's just such a mission critical part of your business is how your goods and supplies are moving through various countries, crossing borders, and being able to track all of that and apply security to it. You know, especially if you're in the food and beverage industry, how do you protect from contamination? How do you protect from an attack where someone's going to threaten or maybe act upon a threat that poisons some of your shipments? And when I've seen that happen in the past, they have to pull product off shelves. They have to pull product out of the supply chain and basically get rid of it and destroy it because it could have been contaminated. So I think there's a different kind of security aspect here to this that's it's interesting.
Very interesting space.
In the embedded device realm, I had not heard of... Have you heard of Red Balloon before?
No, I figured if anybody did, you would,
right?
Mr.
Yeah.
Embedded Security Guy. I right, know. Yeah.
Haven't heard of them before. They're apparently a world leader. Everyone's the world leader. Like, whenever there's a press release, you're always... Whatever space you're in, you're the leader, you're the world leader. And Red Balloon is the world leader in embedded device security today. It received a Series A of $21.9 million. I really haven't looked into it much more than that.
But this is a big Series A. I mean, 21.9, that's more like a Series B. So I haven't dug into an analysis here on revenue and some other things, but I'm curious, you know, how much revenue they have. To me, this is a really big A. A's usually aren't this big. 10, 12, maybe, but 21, not, this is big. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. You know, they're going after the embedded device IoT market. Obviously, somebody was going to go here eventually. I'm not sure how they do it yet in their technology stack. That's a research project for you. You should take a look at what are they doing.
Yeah. So the website, one of the websites we rely upon is Owler. And there certain pages on Owler today just aren't responding. So I was dealing with that problem and not able to really dig into some of these companies. So, but speaking of Series A, Matt, what is, in your opinion, what's a normal Series A and what's a larger Series A? And then the follow on is like, what conditions exist for a company to get a really big Series A?
Yeah, and we've got one more story here that is a typical A, right? To me, an A is 5 to 8 million. 6-7 is kind of where I like it because there's a couple factors that you have to think about when you're raising funds, and we've done shows on this before in the past, is you got to think about when you take a round, what's the valuation to the revenue to think about the exit side, right? And so the bigger A you take without revenue, the multiples start to get a little out of whack. And if you take too big of an A without revenue, then what starts to happen is you start to lock yourself out of strategic acquisition deals, because the expectation of the investor and the revenue are misaligned, right?
So wait,
there's ratios that you have to deal with.
It's kind of like being upside down on your mortgage.
Yeah, kind of. Mm-hmm. And so when you take a $21.9 million A, for example, assume a 4X, that means you're putting an $80 million plus dollar valuation on the business. Divide by 10, you should be driving $8 million worth of revenue. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's a simple math, right?
Gotcha.
If those metrics aren't in place, you just made it really, really hard to get acquired.
Yeah.
As an exit point.
Right.
Which means, look, you're going to raise more money and you're going to have to eventually show that revenue traction to get there. Now, take the other side, right? Let's say, you know, you raise $5 million. Now that's a 20. Divide by 10. Now I got to get to $2 million of revenue with a $5 million in to be considered a strategic acquisition. Again, just simple math, but that's the math founders have to play sometimes,
right,
to understand how much to raise or how little to raise based on where you are in your revenue streams, right? So you take the last article, which is another Denver security startup. Woohoo! Mm-hmm. Love the Colorado startups.
Oh, you is know, this threat, really good... ThreatX?
Yeah, ThreatX.
Okay. Yeah.
Now... So, I mean, Colorado's had a good little startup community here on the north side of town, primarily in Tech Center, Denver, up through the Boulder Exchange. And so ThreatX, another one. This one's 8.2 million. That's what I would expect an A to look like.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me, right? And GrowTech and Access Venture Partners, both Colorado funds here.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a number of deals locally. Great little thrive. I had a call with Brett a few weeks back. We're actually discussing some of the data Layered Insight has and how that might enhance some of the stuff they're doing on the WAF.
Yeah, side. I wanted to ask you what your assessment was of their play in the market, because they're touting themselves as a WAF for cloud-based solutions. And how does that tie into container security? How does that tie into your AWS strategy and how you deploy? How does this tie in today? I think most of us in the security community have kind of poo-pooed the WAF in a traditional sense. I think we're almost seeing a reemergence of it, maybe in the cloud, but also I see a reemergence in protecting some legacy applications and being a good application for that, especially as we move forward in the DevOps process. Those legacy applications are like, yeah, we're getting rid of those. We're writing new apps, but I need something in the meantime to protect my legacy apps. That's typically when I'll recommend a WAF. How does this play into the cloud, though?
Yeah, so it's a combination of cloud and I think some hybrid stuff. I mean, you know, we know that there are some older technologies in the space that haven't really addressed aspects of the cloud infrastructure that well. You're actually seeing also container-specific WAFs, like what NeuVector is doing, for example. Mm-hmm. They're trying to create this WAF between the containers. From my understanding, that's not what these guys are doing, right? They're trying to fill a gap of customers who need, you know, more feature functionality to support their new applications as they're moving them to the cloud. They might also be bridging some aspects of on-prem and hybrid. Really is kind of a replacement for Imperva. Realistically, right? I mean, Imperva's kind of stuck a little bit in where they've been. And so this is kind of the next evolution of that. There still is a need. You know, when we talk about Layered Insight, we're container specific, right? So we're in the container, we're monitoring all this activity in the container. We're not sitting on the top side, right? And so, you know, having a WAF up there in certain cases probably still makes sense in certain areas. And so then how do the two play together? How does information that we have help improve the WAF because they're protecting kind of the front door. And so that's where I see some of these technologies kind of fitting in. We'll see where we go. I know the team's pretty excited.
The question that I often get in this context is when we talk about, well, should I have a WAF for my web application? Should I put some type of agent either or code or hook inside of my container? Inside of my application, right? We're talking about RASP and all those technologies. I think the most commonly asked question is, how does that impact performance? And certainly that's my question, you know, having rolled out apps here at Security Weekly and having websites, like you put anything in between the end user and that application, now that's just another bump in the road for performance. And how do we achieve that? And certainly I get the question from developers, I get it from IT ops, and I get it from security. Even security is worried about, I don't want to implement a solution that's going to impact performance because then like I'm the bad guy now and that's bad. Like I don't want to mess with, you know, our mission critical applications. So how do we combat performance, Matt?
Yeah, you're going to get a chance to test this out a little bit in a week or two. So we should revisit this conversation, right?
I'm excited.
But you're right. We have to figure out how to keep latency and impact to performance low. And there are some examples of some of this that we've seen in the past, right? So think about the APM vendors, New Relic and AppDynamics, right, that are doing a level of instrumentation in the containers to do application performance monitoring. Mm-hmm. It's a similar approach that we use at Layered Insight, for example, but we go deeper, right? Because we're digging into sys, file, and network activity, right? That overhead can't impact performance as an APM, right? And so, you know, we see similar kinds of, I think what we will see is similar kind of overhead, which is low, maybe 1-2%. But then you look at other solutions that are trying to tackle containers, for example, where you're trying to use a privileged container and redirecting all the container traffic through this privileged container. Think about the overhead. Think about the scalability limitations of decrypting traffic, re-encrypting traffic, trying to do old-fashioned threat detection and response. That to me has a ton of overhead, and I think people will start to realize that we don't want to go that way, and so I think this is going to continue to play out a little bit, Paul. The WAFs have to be really low latency in what they do if they're going to continue to address the need of sitting in front of the web server and protecting the application from potential malicious users. As long as they can keep latency low, those technologies continue to scale out. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting tech that's evolving.
Just
trying to take an old school approach and shove it in, and I don't think they scale very well when you think about what they're trying to do.
Matt, have you looked at what Nginx is doing?
A little bit, not a lot. They were at AWS Summit. I didn't get a chance to go over and see them, but they are definitely on the forefront of the web server side in the container space. A lot of people who download Nginx is that piece.
Yeah, when I think of optimized performance for my web server platform, right, I think of Nginx, and certainly migrating some of my own applications to that, it's really awesome. But and I don't understand what their enterprise microservices play. They just made an announcement, and I'm still trying to figure it out, but I think they want to play in this space. And for me, that would be a great addition. Like if you're already running Nginx and now you're including that in your application, it's deployed inside of a container, and I can just apply some rules to Nginx, that breeds a little more confidence. I'm not sure that's exactly what Nginx is doing, but they're definitely migrating and moving their messaging into the microservices realm.
Yeah, because the space they play really is on the web server side and kind of the potentially the front end and aspects of the back end of the API communications.
Yep.
And so that's kind of where they fit in the microservices realm is they're playing that piece. And then there's a whole bunch of other microservices in the middle. So my guess is they're really trying to batten down the hatches in the pieces that they play in well, which is, you know, serving up web pages and maybe RESTful API endpoints, for example. But
yeah.
I don't know. I haven't looked at the broader story, so I can't tell.
Cool. Well, I think that rounds out the startup news for today and the show. Thank you very much, Matt, for appearing on Business Security Weekly. And thank you, everyone, for listening and watching. We'll see you next time.